Today is Monday, June 28th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden faces crucial week on infrastructure bill.
The bipartisan plan calls for $1.2 trillion to be spent on roads, bridges, railways, public transportation, and airports.
Plus, UN denounces systemic racial discrimination against minorities.
I'm calling on all states to stop denying and start dismantling racism, to end impunity and build trust, to listen to the voices of people of African descent.
Also, alarm bells in North Korea over leaders' weight loss. Our top story is in the U.S. The U.S. military is conducting an assessment of airstrikes on Sunday against what it says were, quote, facilities used by Iran-backed militia groups, unquote, near the border between Iraq and Syria. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said the militia were using the facilities to launch unmanned aerial vehicle attacks against U.S. troops in Iraq. Kirby said the U.S. military targeted three operational and weapons storage facilities, two in Syria and one in Iraq. He described the airstrikes as, quote, defensive, unquote, saying they were launched in response to, unquote, ongoing series of attacks by Iran-backed groups targeting U.S. interests in Iraq, unquote. For more, I spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
There is concern on Capitol Hill. We have heard from Senator Chris Murphy. He's a Democrat from Connecticut. He issued a statement expressing concern that the pace of the attacks from these Iranian-backed groups and then the retaliatory attacks from the U.S., he said that this was concerning and this was starting to look like a pattern of hostilities is what he called it. So he said that congressmen and women on the Capitol were going to get some sort of briefing from the White House about these airstrikes on Monday today. And so we will have to wait and see if the U.S. will continue to strike back, or we will wait and see if maybe this was the deterrence needed to stop these Iranian-backed groups from trying to strike U.S. forces with these drones.
How successful do you know were these strikes?
We are being told by the Pentagon that they were very successful, that they hit all of their targets. And we have also found out from a war monitoring group, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, that at least five Iranian-backed Iraqi militia fighters were killed during these strikes and others had been wounded. Usually when the United States carries out these strikes, if you talk to officials, they say that the goal is to take out the capabilities. So they're not actually looking to kill bodies per se. They just want to make sure that facilities are extinguished. But, you know, if there was somebody making drones, they could make themselves a target as well. But the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby did say that these were successful strikes and they hit all three targets that they were going after.
Does this complicate President Biden's search for peace in the region, especially the ongoing talks with Iran?
It certainly doesn't make things easier on the one hand, but I think that the Biden administration is putting the security of its U.S. forces first. And let's be clear that while the Biden administration is pulling out of Afghanistan, they still have troops in Iraq and Syria. They say there's about 2,500 troops in Iraq and about 1,000 U.S. troops in Syria, helping to rid that area of ISIS because there still are remnants of ISIS in there. And so for the Biden administration, they have made it clear with these strikes, the strikes that happened over the weekend, the strikes that happened in February, that U.S. forces protection will come first.
What do you say of critics who are accusing the president of deliberately striking these targets just to divert attention from our problems at home?
I can tell you, as someone who has traveled with the commander who oversees the military operations in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan and the entire Middle East, General McKenzie would not do that. That's not what these strikes are for. That's how he's explained that to me, that any of these strikes are to protect the U.S. forces. The U.S. has a legitimate interest in Iraq and Syria to prevent Islamic State from returning. So that is why they are legitimately there. They are building up their partner forces there in Iraq, in Syria. And the Iraqis have asked them to be there at this point. The Syrians that they're working with have asked them to stay there. So this isn't sort of puffing up anything for no reason. There's a legitimate reason to be there. There were legitimate targets that have been trying to strike U.S. forces. And so that is a low-level response to what's going on.
That's VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb speaking with me from Washington. The Biden administration's $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure agreement on spending to rebuild roads, bridges, and other projects
faces a critical week that could determine the scope of U.S. infrastructure investment. Michelle Quinn reports.
Now comes the hard part. The fragile agreement between President Joe Biden's administration and a bipartisan group of senators on U.S. infrastructure spending must win even broader support from lawmakers in both parties. What remains uncertain is whether the limited bipartisan plan is what will get done, or if a more ambitious and likely more polarizing Democratic-backed bill can pass Congress. The bipartisan plan calls for $1.2 trillion to be spent over 8 years on roads, bridges, railways, public transportation, and airports, as well as improvements to the power grid and the expansion of broadband internet access. To help pay for these projects, the plan reportedly relies on unused pandemic aid and other means. On Saturday, Biden walked back a statement he had made that appeared to link his support for the agreement to the passage of another spending bill on so-called human infrastructure, such as elder care, education, and child care. That $6 trillion package would include tax increases on the wealthy. Some Democratic leaders have said they are not happy with a slimmed-down bipartisan package.
I can't vote for some small subset that, you know, the infrastructure train leaves the station and child care gets left on the platform. Green energy gets left on the platform. Billionaires don't have to pay gets left on the platform. It's that all of the pieces have to move because ultimately it's one deal.
To surpass a filibuster in the evenly divided Senate, the bill will need 60 votes. Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat who was part of the bipartisan group, says there's time for working on a bigger infrastructure bill.
We have two tracks, and that's exactly what I believe is going to happen. And we've worked on the one track. We're going to work on the second track. There's an awful lot of need.
Senator Rob Portman, a Republican who also worked on the deal, says the smaller infrastructure package is a chance to get something done.
People are looking for us to get something done, specifically on infrastructure, but more generally to work together to solve big problems.
The White House and Democratic leaders are hoping both packages will be passed in July. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Pope Francis and U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken met a few hours ago in the Vatican, a meeting that comes as Roman Catholic bishops in the United States are threatening to deny communion to President Joe Biden. It was not clear if that topic came up during their 40-minute meeting. The U.S. bishops plan to deny communion to any American politician who support a woman's right to abortion, even if they oppose the practice personally. Blinken has held a series of meetings while in Italy, including talks on Sunday, with Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid. He told Lapid the U.S. supports Israel's accord to normalize relations with several Gulf states, but it cannot be a substitute for engagement between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. In their first meeting since Israel's new government was sworn in 2 weeks ago, Blinken said he also would discuss humanitarian aid to Palestinian territories.
We have, of course, the situation in Gaza, where there is an urgent need both for humanitarian assistance and more broadly, reconstruction. We'll talk about that. The work I hope that can be done to, as you say, offer a more hopeful future for everyone, Palestinians and Israelis alike, with equal measures of opportunity and dignity is very important from our perspective. Brightly noted, our strong support for the normalization agreements, the Abraham Accords with Israel's neighbors and beyond. We strongly support this, and hopefully there'll be other participants. I think we've also discovered, or perhaps rediscovered, that as important as they are, as vital as they are not a substitute for engaging on the issues between Israelis and Palestinians that need to be resolved. Beyond that, we have many things to talk about when it comes to the region, including Iran. I very much look forward to that. The closest of friends do, we will have occasional differences. We have the same objectives. Sometimes we differ on the tactics. And we, I think, are very clear and direct with each other when that's the case. And that's exactly the way it's supposed to be. But the foundation is a commitment. A deep, enduring, abiding commitment on the part of the United States to Israel's security, and a commitment that President Biden brought with him to office and feels very, very strongly about.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. Racism against people of African descent remains systemic in many parts of the world, the U.N. Human Rights Chief said in a video address published on Monday, calling for states to dismantle discrimination and prosecute law enforcement officials for unlawful killings. Michelle Bachelet, in a global report sparked by the murder of George Floyd by a police officer in Minneapolis in May 2020, said racial profiling by police is entrenched in North America, Europe, and Latin America. Structural racism affects minorities' access to jobs, healthcare, housing, and education, she said. Bachelet welcomed a promising initiative by U.S. President Joe Biden, who signed an executive order in January to address racial inequity across the United States.
The status quo is untenable. Systemic racism needs a systemic response. We need a transformative approach that tackles the interconnected areas that drive racism and lead to repeated, wholly avoidable tragedies like the death of George Floyd. I'm calling on all states to stop denying and start dismantling racism, to end impunity and build trust, to listen to the voices of people of African descent, and to confront past legacies and deliver redress. We examine death at the hands of law enforcement officials in different countries with varying legal systems and found striking similarities and patterns. Several families described to me the agony they faced in pursuing truth, justice, and redress, and the distressing presumption that their loved ones somehow deserve it. It is disheartening that the system is not stepping up to support them. This must change. States must show a stronger political will to accelerate action for racial justice, redress, and equality through specific time-bound commitments to achieve results. This will involve reimagining policing and reforming the criminal justice system, which have consistently produced discriminatory outcomes for people of African descent. Only approaches that tackle both the endemic shortcomings in law enforcement and address systemic racism and the legacies it is built on will do justice to the memory of George Floyd and so many others whose lives have been lost or irreparably damaged.
That's UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet. Before and after videos compiled by Reuters show that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un appears to have grown thinner recently. On Sunday, the country's tightly controlled media offered a rare public segment on it, although the reason for the weight loss is unclear. Matthew LaRotonda of Reuters reports.
North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is apparently losing weight so quickly that people in that country are worried for him. That's according to North Korea's tightly controlled media, and before and after videos compiled by Reuters do show he seems to be noticeably thinner. For example, earlier this month, North Korean TV aired footage of Kim attending a party meeting, but a different video that's said to be from only about 4 months earlier in February and is shot from the same angles shows a different figure. Foreign analysts had noticed the change several weeks ago, and on Sunday, North Korean TV did a rare segment on Kim's health. It broadcast video of North Koreans watching Kim on television. This man, said to be a Pyongyang resident, is saying that the leader looks emaciated and that it breaks the people's hearts. It's not clear why Kim may have lost weight, and the report didn't offer any details.
That's Matthew LaRotonda of Reuters. New York prosecutors have told lawyers for former U.S. President Donald Trump they must respond by Monday with any last arguments as to why criminal charges should not be filed against his family businesses, the Washington Post reported on Sunday. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
A deadline has been set for the Trump Organization's defense team to submit final arguments against possible criminal charges. That's according to a Washington Post report over the weekend, which added former U.S. President Donald Trump's team has until Monday to provide material to New York state prosecutors. On Friday, the New York Times reported that Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance could announce criminal charges against the Trump Organization and its chief financial officer as soon as next week. Vance's office has said it was investigating, quote, possibly extensive and protracted criminal conduct, which includes possible tax and insurance fraud and business record falsification. Court filings and subpoenaed records in the investigation showed that CFO Alan Weiselberg and his son have received corporate gifts worth tens of thousands of dollars in their years with the Trump Organization. Legal experts have said that they could face criminal liability if they fail to account properly for the money on financial filings. A Trump Organization lawyer did not immediately respond to requests for comment. and a Vance office spokesperson declined to confirm the Post report. Legal experts have said an indictment against the Trump Organization could bankrupt the company and drain its influence, but it's also possible that no charges will be brought.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. South Africa has reintroduced tough restrictions, including a ban on alcohol sales and an extended nightly curfew, as it fights a fast-increasing surge of COVID-19 cases. President Cyril Ramaphosa says the Delta variant that was first discovered in India appears to be driving South Africa's new increases. South Africa recorded more than 15,000 new cases on Sunday, including 122 deaths. That brings its total fatalities to nearly 60,000. The country's most populous province of Gauteng is seeing the brunt of the current surge, accounting for about 66% of new infections. The province includes the largest city of Johannesburg and the capital, Pretoria.
The situation has gotten worse. Along with many other countries on our continent, Africa, South Africa is seeing a massive resurgence of infections. And on the recommendation of the National Coronavirus Command Council, Cabinet has decided that the country should move to adjusted alert level 4. Cabinet decided that to ensure that our response is appropriate and proportionate, in other words, equal to the current situation, additional restrictions are necessary. And we are therefore announcing this evening that we will place these additional restrictions in place for the next 14 days. Curfew will be in place from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. and all non-essential establishments will need to close by 8 p.m. The sale of alcohol, both for on-site and off-site consumption, is prohibited.
That's South Africa President Cyril Ramaphosa. Malaysia's leader said the country will indefinitely extend a near-total lockdown that's been in place for a month as coronavirus infections remain high. Prime Minister Muhyiddin Yassin on Sunday said the lockdown won't be eased until daily new cases fall below 4,000, the vaccination rate reaches 10%, and demand is reduced for intensive care in hospitals. The National Banama News Agency quoted Muhyiddin saying he hopes this will happen by mid-July. The lockdown was set to expire Monday. This is the Voice of America. Iran says it hasn't yet made a decision about whether to extend an agreement with the UN Atomic Watchdog over access to surveillance footage at its nuclear sites. The remarks by the spokesman of the Foreign Ministry on Monday come after a three-month deal between Tehran and international nuclear inspectors to preserve video data at the country's nuclear installations expired last week, following a one-month extension. Iran began limiting the access to inspectors from the UN Atomic Watchdog to its nuclear sites earlier this year. Police say suspected militants have fatally shot a police officer, his wife, and their daughter in Indian-controlled Kashmir. Police said anti-Indian militants entered Officer Fayaz Ahmed's home in the southern Tri area late Sunday and fired indiscriminately at those inside. Ahmed was killed immediately, while his wife died a few hours later in the hospital. Their 23-year-old daughter died in a hospital early Monday. In a statement, police labeled the incident, quote, a terror attack, unquote. Australia is battling to contain several COVID-19 clusters around the country in what some experts have described as the nation's most dangerous stage of the pandemic since the earliest days. Sydney in the east and Darwin in the north were locked down Monday. Perth in the west made masks compulsory for 3 days and warned a lockdown could follow after a resident tested positive following a visit to Sydney more than a week ago. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The UN independent expert on protection against violence and discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity, Victor Madrigal-Barlos, is calling for the global elimination of laws that criminalize same-sex unions by 2030. His report has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Currently, 69 countries criminalize homosexuality or some form of gender identity. Nearly half are in Africa. Among them are a handful of countries that applied the death sentence for same-sex sexual acts. They include Brunei, Iran, Mauritania, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and northern Nigeria. UN independent expert Victor Madrigal-Bolo says as of today, 2,000 million people live in criminalized environments. He says there is no justification under international human rights law for maintaining criminalized legislation in relation to sexual orientation or gender identity.
My work has produced abundant evidence to the effect that these criminalizing provisions, even when they are not applied, they create a context that is hostile to the existence of LGBT persons and that is also conducive to blackmail and to significant violence affecting the everyday lives of these persons.
Madrigal-Bolo notes some countries have taken measures to dismantle homophobic laws. He notes the extraordinary action taken by India's Supreme Court, which by the stroke of a pen freed more than 1 billion people from the threat of imprisonment based on their sexual orientation. He says other countries that have decriminalized their legislation against homosexuality include Botswana, Trinidad and Tobago, Belize, Mozambique, and Angola. Madrigal-Bolo is concerned at the adoption of legislation by countries that limit the rights and freedoms of LGBTQ people. He is critical of the law passed by Hungary earlier this month, banning educational materials and programs for children that allegedly promote homosexuality and transgender identity.
I see nothing in the needs of a democratic society that would justify limiting that freedom. And this is the basis for my concern, as I expressed it to the Hungarian state already months ago, when this legislation began to take shape under that public policy.
On the contrary, the UN independent expert says comprehensive sexual and gender education in schools will likely lead to reduced levels of violence and discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Intense, prolonged, record-breaking, unprecedented, abnormal, dangerous. That's how the National Weather Service described the historic heat wave that is hitting the Pacific Northwest, pushing daytime temperatures into triple digits and breaking all-time high temperature records in places where many residents don't have air conditioning in the U.S. Portland, Oregon reached 44.4 Celsius Sunday, breaking the all-time temperature record of 42.2, which was set a day earlier. The temperature hit 40 degrees in Seattle. The National Weather Service said this was an all-time record for the city, better known for rain than heat. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Makhwele Yabaro, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.